exposing the motives and agenda of the world's most powerful.
Unleashed.
This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, continuing our second hour here. Is your car spying on you? We've done many segments on this show on Unleashed on TNT about the EV mandates, about Elon Musk being urged to shut your car down when it, in the case of anyone in Russia, to punish Russians for their invasion of Ukraine. We've talked about the Ford patent to shut your car down remotely or disable air conditioning and other features if you're late on your car loan. We've talked about on this program the new computer diagnostics in a car that's going to be able to read alcohol in your breath and disable your car that was part of a highway funding bill, which I believe actually went through as part of the things that they will be able to do. Really creepy stuff. But I bet you never thought your car was spying on you. And here's a story. This is a local news station telling about a woman who got her car insurance canceled because her car had been monitoring how many fast braking, how much speeding, what it considered reckless driving, and they were reporting it to various agencies, and it got to her car insurance. It was being bought and sold data without her realizing it. Clip one.
Your car could be spying on you, and at least one automaker is sharing that information with insurance companies. I'm George Estevez in for Justin Farmer.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Linda Stouffer. A Henry County woman learned it was happening to her when her insurance bill skyrocketed, and now she's warning others about the issue. New at 6, Channel 2 consumer investigator Justin Gray is live with how you can find out if your data has also been shared. Justin.
Yeah, Linda, Tanika Clay requested her LexisNexis consumer file. This is it. More than 200 pages, most of it from General Motors data about her driving from the onboard computer in her car.
So this is it.
This is it.
Hundreds of pages.
Hundreds of pages. This is my LexisNexis consumer disclosure report. I'm appalled.
Hundreds of pages of data on Tamika Clay's LexisNexis credit report from her Chevy Camaro.
Connecting to OnStar.
She's learned the OnStar system is tracking things like acceleration events, high speed events, and hard brake events. And GM shared 603 of those entries with data brokers.
OnStar app, you know, you're thinking safety and if it gets stolen, but certainly not spying on me and sending information to the insurance companies.
It's the exact same scenario described in this proposed class action lawsuit filed just one day after Clay received her LexisNexis report this month. Clay requested the report because her insurance had gone up 80%, and when she tried to shop around, an insurance broker sent a denial letter and suggested she check her LexisNexis records to see why.
All this means I'm a bad insurance risk and hike my premiums.
Your car's, you know, essentially turning into a computer and collecting data on you as you drive.
Very frightening. Think about this. They're banning the kind of car you can drive, gas-powered cars, globally. This is coming from the United Nations, the World Health Organization, the World Economic Forum, corporate government collusion. If you have a car, particularly an EV, they can shut it down remotely if you don't pay. They can disable your air conditioning if you're late on a car loan. They can shut you down remotely if they don't like your government's foreign policy in the case of Russia invading Ukraine, where Elon Musk was urged to shut it down. He decided not to. But he could have, apparently. You can shut down a national charging grid with an EV very quickly. And now your car with an onboard computer is monitoring your driving habits, and then they're sharing this information with your insurance company, and then you get canceled, and you can't find any other insurance company that wants you. Now, technically, she may have consented to have this done, I'm assuming, when she bought the car or she got her onboard a guy, whatever, the GM OnStar Diagnostics, that she probably somewhere in the small print, it said it could do this. Very similar to the way people in Colorado, when they signed onto their utility, didn't realize they were actually signing onto the utility, able to control their thermostats, override their control if they made their house too cold in the summer, too warm in the winter, all because of either a energy emergency caused by the climate policies, or because ideological reasons. You shouldn't be that, you can't make it that cool in the summer. You don't need air conditioning that warm. And that's what's happening to the Summer Olympics in Paris, by the way. They're having an air conditioning free building because they don't need air conditioning. It's for the sake of the planet. This is the way they think. This is just more of a Big Brother spying how much we're giving over our freedom and personal privacy and data. This is part two of that same woman's story, driving her car. It reminds me of Knight Rider, the TV show with David Hasselhoff and Kit, the car, the computer. He would talk to the car had a personality, the car would help him strategize, help him get out of jams and come up with ideas. Imagine if that same Kit car computer from the Knight Rider TV show was working against you. You shouldn't have went, you were late on that red light. You went through that yellow light. Ah, you're exceeding the speed limit. And then without your knowledge, ratted you out to your insurance company. So your insurance was canceled and you had to get the equivalent of drunk driving insurance at four times the cost. This is a strange world. Clip two, and this is, by the way, from WSB, the Atlanta affiliate, TV affiliate in Atlanta, Georgia.
After the lawsuit became public, GM announced it is severing ties with two data brokers, telling us in a statement, quote, as of March 20th, OnStar Smart Driver customer data is no longer being shared with LexisNexis or Versic. Customer trust is a priority for us, and we are actively evaluating our privacy processes and policies. Anyone can do what Clay did, request their LexisNexis consumer disclosure report under the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
Never did I imagine that it would be spying on us and sending information about driving habits. That's just unbelievable.
Now, we also reached out to LexisNexis, who tells us in a statement, quote, telematics-based insurance programs can be extremely valuable in helping consumers improve their driving and lower risk. We utilize various channels for consumers to request a copy of their LexisNexis consumer disclosure report and to dispute any data on that report that the consumer feels is inaccurate. And it's not just GM sharing data. In fact, LexisNexis in a 2020 press release said that more than 10 million cars they're getting data from, and they have contracts with five of the 10 top insurance companies. Again, you can request a copy of your LexisNexis consumer report free of charge and see if your data is being collected.
And there you go. And once again, what looks so frightening, insurmountable, local news, a lawsuit, and General Motors backs down and says, we're no longer going to be doing this. That's what it takes. And once again, I just wish we had had this kind of resistance when lockdowns first started. I wish we had this kind of resistance on the climate agenda. But that's all it takes. These big, powerful corporations, everything looks so insurmountable with all their lawyers and high-priced lobbyists and their bottom line and the size. One woman, angry that her car betrayed her, ratted her out to insurance companies, canceled her insurance, files a lawsuit, gets some local media attention that goes viral, and GM puts their tail between their legs and stops this absolute nonsense. So kudos to that. Now, we told you about the story about Ethiopia, and it's just an amazing story. The country of Ethiopia is banning gas-powered cars. They're banning the import of gas-powered cars, not that they're making any. And it's the first country in the world that's just not allowing any more import, the very first one. EVs only. Ethiopia announced plans to ban the import of gas-powered vehicles to reduce its output of planet-warming pollution. And I pointed out the real story here. Only 54% of people in Ethiopia, of its citizens, have access to electricity. So they're mandating a car that over almost half the population couldn't even drive or charge, let alone whether they could afford it, let alone whether there's an EV or even automobile market of any substance in Ethiopia. And I mentioned the president's name, the minister of transport's name was Alim Sime. He has to be bought out. He has to either be virtue signaling, paid off, or he's a politician. But I didn't want to advocate violence that needs to be run out of town like a common criminal, because this is insane what he's doing. Well, on Twitter, someone did a great video, posted this great video of the United Nations. And it was a profile of a girl named Aisha who's talking about development in Africa And unfortunately, her politicians have sold her out to the EV cult. So this is the life of Aisha, 13 years old. Take a look at this UN-sponsored video. And there you have it. They're claiming water should be a right. Yet the same people who run these countries, the same people pushing the climate agenda, are the ones who are punishing people like Aisha, who's 13 years old in Africa. And by the way, the whole video was just what she has to go through every day. She has to walk hours a day to collect enough water to survive for herself and her family. And in countries like this in Africa, and in other poor nations in Asia and South America, you have these virtue signaling leaders making the lives of the people in them much worse, much more punishing. I pointed out on this show before that when I go to all these United Nations, I've been to, I think, 20 out of the last 21, or maybe 21 out of the last 23 United Nations climate summits. The highest participating delegations are African leaders. It's not to say they're more corrupt, but they're the ones promised the most climate cash. Remember the climate cash? So prevalent in the United States that California jurisdictions don't have enough bureaucrats to spend the money. They have to hire more bureaucrats because they don't have people to spend all the money piling up. The reason the African delegation is the most attendance at these UN climate summits is they're promised the most. In other words, and I interviewed a South African development activist, Leon Lowe, who explained that the United Nations Climate Slush Fund gives to the leaders and the bureaucrats and the politicians in Africa who are best able to keep their citizens locked in poverty. And that's what you're seeing in Ethiopia with the ban on gas-powered cars. Cheap, affordable freedom of movement would probably do wonders for them. They need development. They need fossil fuels. They need fossil fuel development. Instead, they're getting hammered with limits on planet warming pollution, as the article said about Ethiopia. It's bonkers. It's nuts. This is the world in which we live. Okay. The former vice president of Pfizer, love to have this guy on the show sometime, Dr. Mike Yeadon, has been red-pilled. This is the guy that was in charge of big pharmaceutical Pfizer, vice president. He says, say no right now to the agenda of central bank digital currency, digital IDs, and the UN Agenda 2030. Keep in mind, your car can now rat you out, report you to your insurance company if you blow a red light. What else can they do? If you didn't even realize your car can do that, where do you see what Mike Yeadon, former vice president of Pfizer, has to say? Clip four.
We are living in a peri-tyrannical situation where there's only two clicks left. when you are required to have digital ID to move around and have a life, and when cashless central bank digital currencies are the only way you can buy and sell, at that point you've lost your freedom. If you follow the breadcrumbs to 2030, anyone can look up the UN 2030 SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals. By 2030, Britain specifically will have no commercial passenger aircraft leaving the country. You will not be able to leave. There will be no ships leaving the country. You will not own private transport. You will have a digital ID to do everything, and you will only have electronic money with which to transact. I would say at that point you are a slave, and because you can see them coming, you should say no. Say no right now. Stop. And the things that are happening are really fantastic, but they go back decades. There's no question that there's been a very long run-up to the level of control that we are going to face if we allow cash to be winked out of existence.
God bless him. That is the exact message that needs to be getting out. We are so close to tyranny. Right now, we still have the ability to fight back. We just saw what happened with General Motors backing down from the car that finks you out to the insurance companies. And Mike Eden, former Pfizer executive, nails it on the head. We can't allow a cashless central bank digital currency society because it'll all be permission-based. You said something that was hate speech on social media. You can't buy groceries until you remove it. You can be canceled, defunded, depersoned, unpersoned. I'm not sure if those are even words. At a blink of a government bureaucrat's eye. And we're seeing one of the most advanced countries using this, of course, is Canada. We saw what Justin Trudeau did in the Emergencies Act, declaring domestic terrorists, the truckers, taking away access to their own money because they were declared domestic terrorists. He had their insurance, truck insurance, canceled for participating in a protest against COVID tyranny. All right. Final clip. Speaking in Poland, Dutch Member of Parliament Rob Ruse describes the various ways unelected globalist technocrats are attempting to seize totalitarian control of society, including using the climate crisis, digital IDs, central bank digital currency, the war on farmers. This is impressive. A member of parliament from Poland gets it. They're speaking out. We have to encourage these dissident voices. We've got to have these kind of voices overtaking the political leadership class. That's where you can get this happen. And we need to keep this going. Clip 5.
The bureaucrats centralists in Brussels are addicted to power. They use or they abuse every crisis. Financial crisis, COVID crisis, Ukraine crisis, energy crisis. And the solution is always the same, and the professor already said it, more European Union. If there's no crisis, and that's the second point, if there's no crisis, they create a crisis. For example, climate change. They call it an existential threat, and the solution is the Green Deal. The Green Deal destroyed our energy system. It is destroying our food system. They are trying to control CO2, but if you control CO2, you control people, because everything we do in life is about CO2 emissions, living, breathing, eating, traveling, living. So if you can control that, you can control people's lives. Now they introduce the digital identity and the central bank digital currency. So they can see everything we do, and they can control everything we do, because they can shut off our financial system whenever they want. We have seen it already in Canada during the COVID crisis. We can have a complete conference about that too, but those two topics, it's used to create a centralized controlled economy, and at the same time, it's taking away people's freedom.
Wow. More leaders like this. This is Rand Paul in the United States, and Polish, speaking in Poland, this is Dutch Member of Parliament Rob Ruse. Sorry about that. My eyes play tricks. He's speaking in Poland, but he's actually a Dutch Member of Parliament, Rob Ruse. These are the kind of leadership, this is the kind of articulation, this is the kind of message that we need to spread. This is the message that the farmers spread in Europe, where they got the they halted the European version of the Green New Deal, called the European Green Deal, in its tracks by spraying manure on government buildings. So kudos to that. All right. We take a break. When we come back, Van Snyder, mathematician, software engineer, formerly at Caltech Jet Propulsion Laboratory for 53 years. We're going to be talking about nuclear energy, green, so-called green energy, the climate crisis, and what America needs to do. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned. Van Snyder will be joining us when we come back.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Caution. You are about to hear
today's news talk and the voice of freedom.
That's what this country's all about.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining the program now is Van Snyder, mathematician, software engineer for Caltech Jet Propulsion Laboratory for 53 years. He's author of the brand new book, which is available on Amazon, just came out this month, March 7th, Where Will We Get Our Energy? A Comprehensive System Examination. Welcome to the program, Van Snyder.
Thanks for inviting me. Happy to be here.
Okay, you talk about how difficult the so-called energy transition is. Is it easier to transition your gender or our energy? I mean, I'm being silly there, but what is the problem? We hear this phrase every day, energy transition. We just got to get off all fossil fuels. I just got an email from Al Gore's group saying that by 2035, we need to be 100% off of fossil fuels. Is that going to happen? Is that realistic? What are your thoughts?
It's physically impossible. And if we were somehow managing to find, say, 30 times more cobalt than actually exists, it would be financially impossible.
And let me just read you what Al Gore's group, this is the email I just received during the Climate Reality Project. The U.S. has more than 2,000 gigawatts of renewable energy waiting for permission to be connected to power lines. That's more than the total capacity of the country's existing power plants. Al Gore's group is claiming that we have all this gigawatts of renewable solar wind just waiting to be hooked up, but basically politics is stopping it. They claim renewable solar wind is cheaper and that the only reason we're still on fossil fuels is government policy and subsidies and fossil fuel companies paying off politicians. What's the truth?
Well, you can't connect it if we continue building transmission lines at the rate we're building now. The total amount we need at the current rate would only take 1,350 years.
So tell me, okay, so let's go through this. How much of U.S. energy basically is powered by fossil fuels? And give us some of the, like, what are they trying to do? I mean, they say 2035, by 2050, you got net zero. You have all these restrictions on energy, on transportation, gas-powered car bans. You have food restrictions coming now in the U.S. on nitrogen-based fertilizer, on animal agriculture, methane. They're all leading us to this vision of a fossil fuel free world of energy where we're all going to be living off the grid. Is that going to happen?
It's not going to happen. It's physically impossible. Right now, we get about 20% of our end user energy from electricity, and about 94% of our electricity comes from fossil fuels. So we're getting about maybe 3 or 4% from renewables in total energy picture.
Wow. Now, what brought you to write about this picture? What your background, you were with Caltech Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Why did you feel the need to start to write, put pen to paper and write where will we get our energy, a comprehensive system examination? What brought you to write this? Were you concerned about our future, or do you think like, oh, everything's going great, I want to write a book to support it? Like, tell us what your thought process was and what your book's about.
Well, I read an article in Scientific American entitled Smarter Use of Nuclear Waste in December 2005, and that got me to studying energy. And when I started studying energy, I realized that all of the discussion was about an individual component here or an individual component there. Now, the subtitle on my master's degree says system engineering, and I started thinking, what happens if you look at the whole system? And if you look at the whole system, and there's about 20 or 30 topics in there, like start with materials and end with destruction and disposal, nobody had ever discussed that. So I put that together into a one book.
So this would be the equivalent of a doctor who someone says, you know, oh, my leg hurts. Not just looking at the leg, but maybe looking at the heart and the circulatory system, looking at the whole body person is what you're getting at, and not just focusing on the one flashpoint.
That's an excellent analogy.
Okay, so when you look, as you say here, a comprehensive system examination of our energy system, did you just look at the United States, or was it global?
I looked globally, but not in nearly the same depth as I looked at the U.S.
Okay, so you looked globally, but you were a little bit more in the U.S. Okay, what did you find? When people say, you know, let's start with an EV. It's simple. It's in the news every day. An EV is earth friendly. We need to ban gas powered cars. Is that true? Are electric vehicles earth friendly? If you're worried about CO2 emissions in the atmosphere, is an EV the way to go?
Well, there are a bunch of opinions on that. One of them came from VW, where an engineer calculated that in order to run an electric Golf in such a way that its ultimate CO2 emissions are less than a diesel Golf, that's pretty much equivalent, you have to drive it 125,000 kilometers before the CO2 emitted by its construction is made up for by the non-CO2 emissions from the German electricity mix. Of course, it would never break even in China, where essentially all of the electricity comes from coal. A Norwegian engineer calculated that for an electric Volvo driving in Norway's 92% hydro, essentially carbon-free mix, you have to drive the Volvo for 45 years, but it only lasts 15 years. So the answer is no.
The answer is no. So when the components, talk to a little bit about what goes into like a 1,000-pound EV electric vehicle battery. People just think that, so, you know, it's sort of assembled and then you recharge it on a grid and it's all carbon free. But there's a lot of fossil fuel production that goes into making one electric car battery. Can you give us a little bit of the background of that?
Well, I don't have the numbers in front of me on this computer, but lithium is actually a very small component of a lithium ion battery. There's a lot of copper, there's a lot of nickel, there's a lot of cobalt. There's a professor at Adelaide University who is also a professor at the Geological Survey of Finland, and he wrote a comprehensive report that examined the system of technology units that IEA demands we have to build. And he says that if we actually tried to do it, we would need 1.6 times more copper than the world is known to have, 13 times more nickel, 40 times more cobalt, and so we can't do it. Now, that includes everything, but a huge chunk of that is batteries for cars and batteries for backup to get firm power from electric, solar and wind.
Well, so how come that, why do you think those kind of calculations aren't put into use or by the automakers, by government policymakers, by the United Nations pushing this? Why don't they put those factors when they're considering the sort of environmental impact of a electric vehicle or electric vehicle battery? Why is that missing? You worked at Caltech Jet Propulsion Lab. I mean, weren't policymakers supposed to be advised on the whole picture? Like, how did this happen, you think, where the green agenda, they're not looking at all the facts you just stated?
Well, I don't want to get into conspiracy theories about why they're only looking at components instead of entire systems. I wrote letters to my local government, state government, federal government, including the Department of Energy, and said, please send me the comprehensive system engineering study that includes everything, costs, materials, operations, destruction. And nobody even answered and said, gee, I'm sorry, we don't have that. They just didn't answer. So I don't know if they intentionally didn't do the system engineering study or they did it and they have an agenda.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed that way. All right, well, let's say like solar and wind power, right? This is, I think you said 3% of our energy production is solar and wind. They're constantly bandied about as cheaper, growing faster, more reliable, and the whole world, in fact, in African nations and poor nations, they're told to leapfrog, not even go to fossil fuels and just go straight to solar and wind. Because they can't make the same mistakes we in the wealthy West did. What's your thought on that? Are solar and wind, maybe they're different than EVs. Are they really green? Are they really earth-friendly? Are they less environmentally destructive than, say, fossil fuels?
Well, it depends on which destruction you want to look at. But if you look at things like mining for the materials and fabricating the materials, and then ultimately the decommissioning and destruction or storing of the stuff, they are incredibly dangerous to the environment. Mike Schellenberger wrote a book about this called Apocalypse Never. And at the end, he asked the question, must we destroy the environment to save the planet?
Yeah, which is a great question, but it does. So, but how do these myths persist? I mean, you know, we are told repeatedly that wind is so cheap and solar is so cheap that we have to, you know, that the only reason stopping it is essentially the big oil companies and fossil fuel companies are paying off politicians. Do you see that at all? I mean, give me some of the negative issues, first of all, with fossil fuels. How destructive are fossil fuels to the environment, both in the mining and extraction and also in the emission side?
Well, coal is kind of destructive in the mining side. We know how to burn coal clean so that the only emissions are water and CO2. They don't even emit sulfur dioxide from modern plants anymore. But that's not the main problem. The problem is that because of the subsidies, solar and wind are so incredibly expensive that they have tons and tons of money to spend on lobbyists to perpetuate the Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, it does seem. So let's go through that. Now, coal, you say, is the most destructive of mining. I said coal would have the highest carbon dioxide emissions if people were worried about that. Are you worried about that? When you look at your book as a system analysis, are you looking at carbon dioxide as a way to avoid it? Is that factored in, or do you not think that carbon dioxide is the threat that they make it out to be?
Well, I disagree that carbon dioxide is a threat. I read a very interesting monograph by Patrick Moore, who's one of the co-founders of Greenpeace Canada, and they kicked him out of the church when he became heretical and said, maybe there's a problem here. His interesting monograph was about the benefits of carbon dioxide. He observed that CO2 has been declining from about 2,500 parts per million 150 million years ago to 350 parts per million in 1750. And if you extrapolate that line, it goes below 150 parts per million in about 6 million years. Now, what happens at 150 parts per million? The plants die. And when the plants die, everything dies except for viruses and bacteria and maybe some fungi. So Gaia is slowly committing suicide. But the Industrial Revolution raised CO2 to 415 parts per million. So we've postponed her suicide to about 18 million years. I can tell you where that CO2 is going if you have the time.
Yeah, please do. Where's it going?
Well, plants and animals in the oceans worked out how to combine calcium with carbon dioxide to make calcium carbonate, which we know as limestone and chalk. And when they die, that sinks to the bottoms of the oceans and it becomes permanent limestone or chalk in the bottom of the ocean. So it's sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere.
So it's actually, okay, so it's sucking it out of the atmosphere. So, you know, you were at Caltech Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Why do you, and you take this system approach to everything. You know, we have a society which just seems to reject that. Give us a little bit on the background. Why is it people just look at sort of the one part and not the sum of the total or the system of the total? Is that sort of human nature? You sort of just focus on the moment, the sparkly little shiny thing, and you forget the larger picture. Is that an easy thing to happen? Do you see that happening? You're mentioning that it's happening with green energy. Does it happen in other walks of life, in other areas of science as well?
Oh, it definitely does. The people who have the most influence seem to be the ones who want you to focus on just one component. You're simply just one shiny thing. They're very influential.
Yeah, how does that come about? I mean, you know, as an engineer and seeing this, and especially in big universities, how do you combat that? In other words, it seems like that's going to continue to give us misguided policy for, you know, in infinity. How do you, what's the best way to take the engineer all system approach when someone who's very well spoken, someone who's essentially lobbying for you just to look at the one aspect, like EVs, like, oh, look, there's no gas here, so therefore they're better, ignoring all of the rare earth mining, ignoring all of the extracting, ignoring all of the recycling issues with it. How should we approach that when in the future and currently? How do you get people onto a system approach, which you have adapted?
Well, I'm not sure how you would do that in the current environment when there are small groups of people who have strong interests not to do that. And this is actually nothing new. There's a guy named Charles McKay who wrote a book in 1841 called Extraordinary Memoirs of Extraordinary Popular Delusions. That was 1841. And if you read the stories about the Dutch tulip craze, or the French Louisiana scheme, or the British South Sea scheme, and you say, that's just like today.
Yes, and there's even been analysis comparing the sort of hysteria over our climate today to the witchcraft trials. And there was actually, I think it was Harvard University, someone did a study, Emily Oster was her name, linking cold times and bad weather to accusations of witchcraft. And that was, of course, like you mentioned, that was sort of a delusions of the crowd at the time. So how do you think we can get out of this? How do you take this system-based approach in our current environment? I mean, you have a very polarized country. You have Europe, you have farmers fighting this green agenda. You have the people suffering under high energy costs and blackouts and shortages. In the United States, you have all these states following California. And California, of course, is the most green energy promoting state. And all these other states follow. I live in Virginia. We follow California. They ban gas-powered cars. We ban gas-powered cars to save the planet. So how do you think we can get a system-based approach more and more into our culture?
Well, it starts with education. K through 12 is entirely designed to produce college students, and college is entirely designed to produce professors. We need to have education that actually produces education instead of more people to run the education.
I've interviewed several professors on this show. One of them, Dennis Rancourt, who had written about, he was a tenured professor who left his University of Ottawa, I believe. And he described it as the way young science students are being raised today is they're trained to be obedient intellectuals. In other words, they're designed not to rock the boat, to be one of the consensus of experts. Do you agree with that assessment? Or especially the younger people in science getting science degrees, are they just being trained not to question the whole picture, but to just go along with whatever agenda is essentially being pushed by the powers that be?
They are being trained to do that, and they are also being penalized when they disagree. In fact, Voltaire wrote about that. He said that it's very dangerous to be right when men of influence are wrong.
Yes. Now, you worked at Caltech Jet Propulsion Laboratory 53 years. What was the culture like there? Was it a culture that accepted dissident voices? Did it accept dissent? Or were you rewarded for dissent? Did they look at the system approach, or was it the same sort of problems that we face today?
We looked at the system approach, and if we hadn't looked at the system approach, which started with Ranger, when the first six Rangers didn't work, And my major professor for my master's degree was the person who brought system engineering to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. His name was Carlton B. Soloway. Unfortunately, he's deceased. And had it not been for that, nothing of the magnificent accomplishments of JPL would have happened without system engineering.
Wow. How is Caltech Jet Propulsion today? Have they, you know, because we talk about NASA. NASA, the men who put the engineers and scientists who put man in the moon and in space wrote a letter about 10 years ago to NASA, disgusted with the way NASA has essentially been co-opted. Their lead global warming scientist, James Hansen, had been arrested protesting global warming, endorsed a book calling for ridding the world of industrial civilization. And they basically, the men who put man on the moon, lamented what had become of NASA. Has Caltech Jet Propulsion Laboratory still that great system-based approach you remember, or has that been co-opted as well?
It's declining. I worked for two-thirds of the directors at Jet Propulsion Lab, starting with Bill Pickering. Two directors after he retired was Lewis Allen, who had been chief of staff of the Air Force. He was a towering giant of a leader. After him was Ed Stone, the chief scientist for Voyager, and he was basically a buck passer. He was confused whether JPL was a federally funded research and development center or a bunch of grad students competing for grants. The next one was Charles Alagi, who was a brilliant Earth observing system, primarily a radar scientist. And then came Mike Watkins, who was a placeholder. He had been a division manager, didn't get told that he was going to be the next director. So he went to Texas, and then they called him back, and then he retired. And now we have Lori Leshin. Now, I don't know anything about her because she was appointed after I retired, but some of my colleagues are worried that she is just another check-the-boxes placeholder.
Yeah, how did our, in your view, how did scientific institutions like NASA, like even NOAA, get sort of, I want to say, ideologically corrupted, where the, you know, where every head, all these science organizations, the American Meteorological Society, the American Geologists, American Geophysical Union, they have two dozen governing board members who sort of issue these green energy statements, climate statements, and the actual rank and file members like yourself aren't actually polled, consulted. How does that happen and how do we reform it? I mean, this is a problem with what you could call big science in the world today, where it's relying on government funding. I believe Dwight Eisenhower warned about this, the scientific technological elite. Are we at the point where Eisenhower warned is now happening in America?
Yes, we are there and we have been going there for decades. I'm not politically astute, so I'm not really in a position to give strong recommendations about how to correct the problem, other than a shameless economical push to read my book.
Yes. And we take a break, but let's give that book out. It's Where Will We Get Our Energy? A Comprehensive Energy System Analysis by Van Snyder, the author, and also, I guess it says William Van Dyke Snyder. Is that another author? Is that the co-author?
No, I just used half my middle name because my dad's name was William, so we avoided confusion in my family.
I got you. Okay, well, Amazon lists two authors, and I guess they're both you. So, right. Okay. Where will we get our energy? We have to take a break. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano. We're talking to Van Snyder, energy expert. We'll be right back after these messages.
As a combat wounded veteran, I know how hard it is to come home and build a meaningful life. When I was in Iraq, our vehicle was hit. A rocket-propelled grenade exploded right under my seat. Traumatic brain injury, a fractured pelvis, severe burns. They didn't think I was going to make it. I had to learn to walk again and live with the scars, both visible and invisible.
DAV helps veterans like LaToya get the benefits they've earned. They help more than a million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
With DAV on my side, I was able to pursue my dreams. If my story can touch a heart, it can change a life. My victory is overcoming my wounds so I can help other veterans.
LaToya Lucas, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
The next time you think you can illegally handle your mobile phone while driving and get away with it, think again. Phone detection cameras are in operation on New South Wales roads.
Hello.
So if you're driving and illegally handle your mobile phone, you can stop it or cop it.
Fearless, informative, and unfettered, Mark Morano is unleashed on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We're talking with Van Snyder, mathematician, software engineer from Caltech Jet Propulsion Laboratory, worked there 53 years. He's the author of the new book, Where Will We Get Our Energy? A Comprehensive System Examination. All right, Van, I wanted to play you this quick clip of Elon Musk and just get your thoughts. He's, of course, is the maker of the electric vehicle Tesla. And one of the things driving this whole gas-powered car ban and EV push is climate change fear. So I just wanted to get your reaction. This is Elon Musk. Play the clip.
I mean, I meet a lot of people out there who have lost hope. You know, they think it's too late. And they think there's no chance and the Earth is doomed. It's like, it's not doomed. Earth can and will be saved.
All right, that's Elon Musk, the maker of the electric vehicle Tesla. What are your thoughts? Have you, in Caltech, in your scientific engineering world, do you meet people who think the Earth is doomed due to our use of fossil fuels?
I do meet such people, and I meet other people who say, well, that's just not true.
What do you think of what Elon Musk said? Is the Earth, can we save the Earth? Or is that another sort of silly comment to make? Like, the Earth will be saved. We can save it. Implying, I guess, if we do enough, like buy enough EVs or something, buy enough Teslas in the case of Elon Musk, we can save the Earth?
Well, the Earth doesn't need saving. The Earth will keep on going no matter what. But, you know, Elon Musk does have an economic incentive to get people to buy his electric cars. And more power to him. Anybody who wants one should have one. The problem is forcing everybody to do it when it's physically impossible.
All right, let's talk a little bit about wind turbines. You write about that. They apparently require, I guess, rare earth mining. They require even oil to run. They have microplastics in them. Can you talk to me a little bit about the environmental footprint of these wind turbines and also recycling of them?
Well, the environmental footprint is enormous. The density of power that you can extract from wind is extremely small. I mean, there's lots of energy that you could extract from wind, but you need an enormous infrastructure to get it from behind the back of nowhere to where it's actually needed. And that's at least part of the problem. Now, on the decommissioning and recycling end of it, well, wind turbine blades are effectively non-recyclable. People have tried, and they found that the cost is 50 times the value of the materials recovered. So they just pile up in landfills, and they are eternal. Now, you mentioned microplastics. Wind turbine blades are covered with fiberglass that's bonded with epoxy. They don't use polyester resin like they usually do, because polyester resin is destroyed by the ultraviolet rays in sunlight. And epoxy is about 40% bisphenol A, which is banned in packaging because it's carcinogenic. And a typical wind turbine sheds about 65 kilograms of microplastic particles per year. So that bisphenol A ends up, you know, in the fields where we're growing our food and in the water supplies. And so they end up in fish and they end up in livestock, our food, you know, pork and beef and lamb. But it's okay that it's carcinogenic because we're saving the planet.
What about windmills and bird species and bats? Is that a problem? Because I've heard a lot of people say, oh, that's no big deal. Your average common house cat kills more birds. Not your average, but cats kill more than windmills.
Well, cats definitely kill more songbirds, but I've never seen a cat kill a vulture or a condor or an eagle or a hawk or a pelican. I've never seen a cat do that. And those are the apex predators, and there are a few of them. So when a few of them are knocked off, the entire ecosystem of the birds is knocked off kilter. And the same thing is happening with bats. I don't think that the cats kill bats, and they are extremely important.
Yes. Now, you also read about balsa wood, which I don't think anyone thinks about that. It says the average wind turbine contains 15,000 pounds of balsa wood. Why is this a problem if wind turbines use balsa wood? Isn't wood renewable? What's the big deal?
Well, sure, wood is renewable, and balsa is kind of the ideal forestry crop because it grows quickly and has to be harvested young. And it's just, so the Chinese tried to grow it and they failed. So they're out in South America raping the wind, rainforests in Brazil and Ecuador and Bolivia and Peru. And you know, they talk these workers into harvesting the balsa wood. Yeah, we're going to give you a ton of money. We're going to give you $150 a day. So the workers, they go out and harvest it, and they pile it by the road, and the truck comes and takes it away, and they never get paid.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, then no one really considers it. They just say, oh, wow, there's no gas used, so it must be better for the environment. Okay, you cite another study that said 43 million tons off of the wind turbine blade waste is eternally toxic. You said it's toxic, and it could be 40% in China, this waste, 25% in Europe, 16% in the U.S. by 2050. So tell us a little bit about the, how the toxicity of it and our solar panels. You mentioned windmills aren't renewable, aren't recyclable. Are solar panels recyclable?
Well, solar panels also are in principle recyclable. It would actually be easier, but just like for windmills, the cost to do the recycling is 50 times the value of the materials received because solar panels are made from incredibly cheap stuff. Some of those incredibly cheap things are cadmium and tellurium, which are both form water-soluble salts, especially with chlorides, and they end up in the water table, and they're both carcinogenic. So trying to recycling solar panels, just dumping them in a landfill, extremely dangerous.
You say if a wind turbine breaks over a farmer's field, they can't harvest the crop, it hurts the livestock, they can't graze because the fiberglass gets into the groundwater downstream, and downstream people are harmed too. Explain that. Like what's and you said the windmill turbine companies aren't responsible. Is that what's happening here? So if something bad happens, a wind turbine breaks, the farmer's out of luck?
Yeah, the farmer is screwed. And I don't know if that's because legally the wind turbine owner who has leased the land from the farmer is not legally responsible, or he is legally responsible, but he has the resources to outlawyer the farmer.
Okay. You write about the linear no threshold theory of the relationship between radiation and illness. And the reason I bring that up is nuclear energy, ever since the 1970s in particular, has been demonized. You know, you have the movie China Syndrome with Jack Lemmon and Jane Fonda. You have the Soviet nuclear facility. The name's failing me at the moment, but 1987, Chernobyl. And you have all the fears about nuclear. Is nuclear the way to go? Is nuclear toxic? Why are we afraid of nuclear energy?
Well, you mentioned the LNT theory. This was a fraud perpetrated by Herman Muller starting in 1927. And when his grad students said, no, you're wrong, he managed to get their results suppressed. And this was largely sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation. You know, Rockefeller was the big oil interests. They were deathly against nuclear power because they saw it as a competition to their economic interests. So they were the first sponsors of it. And then lots of other people joined the bandwagon because they saw an economic and political benefit in opposing it.
Yeah, and there's also something called hormesis, which I believe is there's a beneficial level of radiation exposure that you can actually have lower cancer risk. Can you explain that at all, or is that a relevant theory? I've heard that before.
Well, Ed Calabrese, he's a professor of toxicology at UMass Amherst. He's written extensively about this. And in every toxin, this has been observed since the time of the ancient Greeks, that it's the dose that makes the difference. And essentially every toxin, small doses are beneficial. For example, we have to have salt in order to survive. But if you eat two teaspoons of salt in 30 seconds, you'll probably die. And the same thing happens with radiation. There was a 10-year study of the survivors of the blasts in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And one guy combined the results for the two or three nearest regions and said, look, there's a linear response. And another guy looked more carefully and said, well, when you get a little farther out, when the dose is less than about 1,100 millisieverts per year, the risk of leukemia is actually lower. And other people have observed that among nuclear power plant workers, the risk of all tumors, not just blood cancers, but solid tumors, is less than in the general population.
All right, we only have about 35 seconds left. Are you confident that we will approach this green agenda and science today with a comprehensive system examination? Or do you think this is, we're still going to be on a bad path for a while?
Well, we're still on a bad path unless there are more people like you who help push back against it.
All right, Van Snyder, the author of Where Will We Get Our Energy, A Comprehensive System Examination Failure. Thank you for joining Unleashed today, Van Snyder.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. See you next time. Stay tuned for more TNT.